I thought that we would spend a little time with a book by Douglas John Hall entitled Lighten Our Darkness, Towards an Indigenous Theology of the Cross. We thought that it might be a good thing this summer, off and on, to introduce people to the books that have shaped Holden Village. Through the years, it's been 20 plus now, Holden has been here and has been sharing its ministry, and part of that is the influence of folks who have never been to Holden by way of their writings. So Maynard Johnson, I think, next week will do a session on Dietrich Bonhoeffer's book Life Together, which has been an important one for the village. The Winter Community discussed Jim Wallace's book Called to Conversion this past winter. The writings of C.S. Lewis have been important, Martin Luther, Dorothea Zola, others. And off and on we have chosen a book as a kind of theme book for the summer. This summer it's a little book that Duane Addison referred to last night, John Poulton's book, Feast of Life. It's a little paperback about the World Council of Churches, and it's available in the bookstore. It must have been about 1980 that John Hall's book, Lighten Our Darkness, was chosen as the theme book. And let me ask if anyone has read it. Okay, I envisioned this hour together as basically an introduction to it, but if someone had read it, then would welcome their remarks as well as my own. Sometimes the blurbs on the back are helpful, sometimes they're not, but it'll give you a little bit of a flavor. Mind shaking and spirit shaking, John Bennett says of the book. Review for Religious, a magazine, says, a challenge to anyone currently interested in the past and future of the church in North America, and indeed the world. Extremely well written and reasoned, Dr. Hall's book offers a new perspective where suffering and failure become norms. We are not to be led out of darkness, but into it, because in darkness, expectation and experience define what it is to be a Christian in today's world. Or from the Union Seminary Quarterly Review, one of the best and most constructive theological critiques of culture and religion to come along in a good while. Then from America Magazine, Hall has certainly done us a service in exploring new possibilities for a contemporary and uniquely American theology of the cross. Now, Douglas John Hall is a Canadian theologian, and so he writes about North American Christianity and North American culture. He says right at the very beginning in the preface, the subject of this book is the failure of a people and the courage that can come to those who contemplate this failure in the perspective of the cross. The people are the North Americans. I'll just share with you the brief walk through the table of contents, and I'll make a few comments in explanation of his chapter titles, and use that as a way to introduce the book. Part one is entitled Positive Christianity and the Experience of Negation. And chapter one is entitled The Officially Optimistic Society, and chapter two, The Experience of Negation. Let me say something about those two. The Officially Optimistic Society. Hall says that North Americans, especially white North Americans, are officially optimistic. No matter what their experience is, they really believe that human beings can master and control the world. And since the Enlightenment, 1800s or so, the dominant image of humanity that has been our guiding image has been humanity as controlling and mastering the world. We envision the world as over against us, kind of stuff that we can manipulate according to our design and use in keeping with what we desire. That image of mastery and control has been an image of backed with phenomenal success. The rise of science and the tie then of science to technology, technology as a practical implementation of science, has seen a couple of centuries of phenomenal progress in terms of mastery and control. Hall has said that mastery and that control has literally gone to our heads. That's how we now see the world, as over against us, that which can be manipulated by our design. And it has given rise to a kind of official optimism, so that, name it what you will, we have seen ourselves living in a times where we expect the future to be better than the past. A notion of progress, a notion of historical mobility. Okay, then the second chapter is the experience of negation. Our image is one of mastery and control, witness the optimism that came with the splitting of the atom, for example. Our experience, however, has not always been in keeping with that. We have experienced failure. Deep down in our bones, we know that the world we have created is not under our control, or all kinds of things happen that double back on us. The splitting of the atom. Remember the time when it was going to be too cheap? The promise was that it was going to be, don't even bother to meter the electricity. It was going to be too cheap with nuclear power to even bother with that. Atoms for Peace program. The splitting of the atom was some way of taking things in our hands, and it was going to work out to human benefit. Now we're poised at the edge of a very scary situation, have been for a long time, when that which we felt we could control is also threatening to destroy the planet itself. We have experienced failure. We thought that we could solve racial conflict without having to sacrifice. We thought that the poor could join the rich would not have to give up what they had attained in order for the poor to come aboard. In just one arena after another, there has been the experience, what he calls the experience of negation, or the experience of cultural failure. Now, Hall says, we've had an optimistic image of ourselves, and we've not denied that there has been evil in the world. We all know the catalog of social woes, whether it's racism or sexism or poverty or imperialism or whatever. But, he says, we have always seen ourselves in such a way that we were able to dissociate ourselves from those evils. They are not us. They are outside us. We have seen ourselves in the role of those evils could be eliminated, and we have seen ourselves in the role of the eliminators. That's the mastery and control thing. Now, what's the third chapter then? Is a chapter entitled The Official Religion of an Officially Optimistic Society. So with this image of humanity in control, but secondly the experience of failure that shimmers in our bones, Hall says Christianity in North America has become a kind of religious sanction for that way of viewing the world and acting in it. That's why he calls it the official religion of the officially optimistic society. In different words, Christianity has adapted itself to the culture of North America, the doctrine of providence that the Puritans brought, in which one was responsible to a God who was a judge and who was active in all things, and you'd better behave in such a way that you were accountable, and you came out on the right side when you were held and stood before God. That doctrine of providence was changed into a doctrine of progress. The doctrine of human sinfulness, which is so present throughout Scripture, was ridded of those elements which were offensive to human rationality and which said that human beings were not in control. Biblically, the sign of one's sinfulness is to regard yourself as supreme in all of creation. There's a kind of human arrogance about our place in the scheme of things. Well, Hall says Christianity in North America has, in fact, become acculturated and has adapted to this doctrine, this image of humanity as master and in control. So that third chapter is a chapter about the acculturation of Christian faith to North American culture. Now, the tragedy here, or the pathos for Hall, is that when then the culture experiences failure and turns to its religious resources, it comes up empty-handed. Because the hope that is at the heart of Christian faith is a hope which looks death and failure square in the face and yet offers a way through and offers courage to face that. But the Christianity that has been acculturated to North American society looks away from death and failure because it is that hope has been replaced by optimism. And if we can't be optimistic about the future, then we face a situation of despair. Our usual reaction, if we cannot find grounds for optimism, is to kind of redouble our efforts to get control of things again. There's an image there in the book that's a rather graphic one. Hall says the way we've been acting the last couple of decades is a little like children on the playground once the bell has rung. You know what happens when they're out playing and the teacher rings the bell? There's this frantic activity to get in one more round before the game is over for good. And you have to go inside and do what teacher says. A kind of desperation in our actions to get and keep things in control. We try to make the culture of optimism and the culture of mastery work for us by saying, it's time to get this country going again, or do some appeal to some such slogans. Okay, it's not adequate to the book. I'm just trying to describe the bare-bone outlines. That's the first part. That's his analysis of where North American culture and Christianity is. And you must go to the book to see how he probes that in depth. The second part of the book is entitled In Search of a Lost Tradition. Hall says it's simply cruel to expose people to their failure without offering an alternative vision and alternative possibilities, alternative resources. So after his critique, he cannot leave the reader there. He says, let's draw upon something from the faith itself as an alternative vision. He must search for it, in search of a lost tradition. Two chapters, exemplars of a thin tradition and the problematic of the theology of the cross. The first one there, exemplars of a thin tradition, is Hall's way of introducing you, the reader, to the theology of the cross. The theology of the cross is a particular strain in the history of the church with particular themes. Paul and Mark are the New Testament writers where it's clearest that you have a theology of the cross. Paul says straightforwardly, we care to know nothing except Jesus Christ and him crucified. He talks about the cross as the power of God and the wisdom of God. And if we want to take a little time with the outlines of the theology of the cross, be glad to do that. It's picked up again in a powerful way with Martin Luther. And Hall, in fact, says, calls upon the Lutherans when he goes around and talks to Lutheran groups to rediscover their own heritage because they are the curators of the tradition of the theology of the cross. The problematic of the theology of the cross is then discussed by Hall, and that focuses on two areas. He asks, is the theology of the cross possible? What he means by that is, in keeping with a distinction made by Martin Luther, distinguished between a theology of the cross and what he called a theology of glory. May not be the best terms, but we can't do a whole lot about that at this moment, anyway. Theology of glory means attaining human wholeness or society's well-being or whatever word you want to use for salvation without dying, without pain, without suffering, attaining wholeness without having to walk the way of the cross or discipleship. And on the other hand, attaining it by way of our own achievements, works. So Hall says the theology of the cross is always inclined to move over into a theology of glory. We're always trying to attain salvation by way of our own achievements and without pain, suffering, loss, the way of the cross. So he wants to ask whether a theology of the cross can be sustained, whether it doesn't always give itself over to a theology of glory. The second area that's a better problematic for him is whether there can be an ethic of the cross. Does the theology of the cross, the way of discipleship, the way of Jesus, not lead itself into ethical quietism and passivity? Is it not inclined to look at failure, suffering, and death, the experience of negation, and simply do its best to kind of accept with them or cope with them rather than an ethic that provides guidance for a way of life in the midst of darkness? So that's just another question. That's just problematic. Okay. That's part two, in search of a lost tradition. He wants to pick up that thin tradition of the theology of the cross. And then part three is the constructive portion of the book. It's entitled An Indigenous Theology of the Cross. By that he means, what would the theology of the cross look like for North Americans? What would it look like if it became part of our way of being in the world? And there are two chapters there, a quest, the quest for a new image of humanity and a way in the darkness. This is in contrast to the first part. Instead of an image of mastery and control, he wants an image of humanity where we are much more feeling ourselves a part of the whole of things, much more receptive to life, participation. We're creatures among creatures, much more participation rather than manipulators. There's a relationship of humanity and nature that he discusses there, and then in keeping with this, an effort to talk about the community of the cross and the shape that the church needs to take or ought to take in North America, a theology of limits, a paradigm for the experience of negation and the church under the cross. Okay, I that might be enough just to give you an idea of what he's up to. It doesn't get into the book in detail, but let's open it up for questions and about the book or comments if you would like, and then maybe via that route I could share some more of Paul's piece. I could say one thing that might be helpful in delineating what he does and does not mean by cross. We often say we all have our crosses to bear. When we say that, we mean that there is some situation in our life that we have to bear with. It's an illness. It's a tragedy that has happened, and now we've got to live with the consequences of it. When Hall talks about the theology of the cross, he does not mean the cross in that sense of some involuntary bearing or suffering that we have to handle. Rather, the cross is a way freely chosen, the particular way of life. It is not a search for suffering, but it is a way of life whereby if you live faithful to the way of Jesus, suffering will come. But it's essentially, it's not we have our crosses to bear in the sense of an involuntary suffering. It's a way of the cross as a chosen path. Sometimes we say, we don't say it so much, but there is a continuation of the notion of cross that affected much of Western history that comes from Constantine. And Constantine saw the cross in the sky and said, saw the insignal, in hoc signo vinci, in this sign conquer. That notion of cross was a notion of which cross represented triumph, conquest, victory. When you hear people talk, well, this is a Christian nation, it's an identification of Christianity with, usually, a nationalism that is a notion of cross. That's not the theology of the cross that Hall is talking about. So not the conquering, triumphant cross of the Crusades and our crusading nationalism, and not the notion of cross of involuntary suffering. It's hard to discuss a book.
You haven't read.
How about historically, is you said Mark and Paul are the presenters of the theology of the cross. How specifically, for instance, in Mark, is the gospel different than in the other renditions that lends you to say that.
Yeah. Let me respond to that, Roger, by giving you five statements which kind of condense Luther's theology of the cross, and then go from that to Mark. Luther's theology of the cross was laid out very early in his career, and the general outlines of it are these, and Hall draws upon Luther in a major way. One, God does not want to be known by that which is invisible, but only by what God has disclosed. This is a response to medieval theology, where there was a great deal of speculation about God, and Luther responded by saying, in effect, God cannot be reached by way of our speculation, and does not dwell in realms ethereal, but only where God has chosen to be disclosed. Okay, and then you have to ask, where is that? So the second baseline in the theology of the cross is that the knowledge of God is hidden in the midst of God's humanity and God's weakness in the world. If you want to find God, you must look where God has revealed God's self, and that's in God's humanity and God's weakness in the world. Well, where is that? That's in Jesus of Nazareth. Everything that is to be known about God, and that is to be known also about ourselves, is to be seen in a poor Jew from Nazareth. That's the theology of the cross. You look elsewhere, you will not find God. So, God is revealed in the sense in the hiddenness of the humanity of Jesus. So the revealed God is hidden then under suffering and the cross. That means in the theology of the cross that the of God's revelation is only then apprehended, only grasped by us in suffering and the cross, understood as Christ's passion and at the same time as the Christian's suffering and cross. So the suffering of Christ and the suffering of those who follow Christ go together for Luther. It's not in our achievements. It's in our faithful following of the same way that Jesus walked, that we come to know God, because that is where God is disclosed. The glory of Jesus, writes Ernst Käsemann, New Testament scholar, is that Jesus enables his disciples to walk the same way he walked. So much of Christianity went to the theology of glory, which says, because Jesus suffered, we need not. Theology of the cross says, Jesus empowers us to walk the way of the cross, which is God's way in the world. That is how God is among us. Okay. In Mark's gospel, focusing on the cross, you also see it manifest in that Jesus is always rejecting the disciples' efforts to make of Jesus a conquering king, a Messiah in the Davidic line. When the notion that Jesus is Messiah is raised to Jesus, Jesus says, don't tell anybody. They won't understand. I am not the king in the way that you want me to be. The disciples don't understand the way of the cross until after the resurrection and they look back and say, aha, this is the way, what God was up to in Jesus. The cross was, for them, a disillusionment. It shattered their expectations. And the resurrection confirmed the way of the cross. It was only the power of the resurrection that allowed them to look back on that, to see that that was the way of God. And in Mark's Gospel, it's also true in the other Gospels, but especially in Mark's Gospel. Mark's Gospel also has people confessing, recognizing God in Jesus Christ, who you wouldn't think would be the ones. It's the centurion that says, truly this is the Son of God. And it's a Roman centurion, not one of the disciples. It's part of the theology of the cross to say that God is hidden. You know, and it's only the eyes of faith that discover that here in this suffering humanity is truly God present. And it's Paul who lifts up the cross as a kind of major symbol for apprehending, as Paul says, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Hall says, and Kaisman too, that the resurrection is a chapter in the theology of the cross. In other words, Jesus' way of being in the world led to the cross. That was the way of the kingdom of God. The resurrection is the confirmation by God that that was the way, or is the way, of the kingdom. And it's Paul who focuses on the cross as a symbol of the power and the wisdom of God.
We had a couple sessions on this a couple weeks ago, and when we got to the question period, I realized that I had not communicated. And as we talked, one of the reasons was people could not get out of the understanding of theology of cross, theology of glory, that they had brought to those two words, namely, uh-huh. Theology of cross is gloomy, theology uh-huh. of glory is happy. And if uh-huh. you're a theologian of the cross, it means you are melancholy and pessimistic and gloomy and don't have any joy. And so they, yeah. people, no matter what I said or what we did, we had to... one line that at least got three nods was, I said, the theology of glory is not theology of happiness or joy or some such thing. A theology of glory is whenever we take the gospel and turn it into privilege for ourselves. That, all right, so we kept trying.
Uh-huh. Has there ever been any large group of Christians since Constantine that... has lived out the theology of the cross? Did it go down with the vision of the cross in the sky?
Well, there have always been groups of Christians. I don't know about how large. I mean, I think the terms of the theology of the cross are stringent enough that it's not going to catch on in a big way.
You know. Is Peter's talk about suffering much
oh,
like
yes.
Mark's?
Oh, yes. Oh,
it
yes.
seemed like it was.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I'm glad you mentioned, because the theology of the cross is very, very strong in the first letter of Peter. Yeah.
I think one of the things that really helped me get that a little bit in perspective, and I'm back here because I need some more. John did a retreat for us in February, and we did Poverty of Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And the Philippians 2 verses, mm-hmm. I mean, all of that helps me get it into my head, but then I have to keep coming back to it again and rereading it, because it seems so easy to slip away and not want to suffer.
Yeah.
And I know that sometimes that's just where we're at.
You're about
to say
something.
Is it wanting to suffer or being willing to suffer? Yeah, I can see there's a big difference in wanting to suffer.
Well, Hall says we all suffer. You know, that's part of life. But how do you respond to that? And in fact, I realize the difficulty here with the theology of cross, theology of glory. For Hall, the theology of glory is one way to respond to suffering, and especially the acute sense of mortality that we, at some point or another, have. You know, when we have to contemplate our own death, how do we respond to that? He says a theology of glory is one which always responds, but usually by denial or by illusion or by coping with it that doesn't really face it head on, deal with it squarely. Whereas a theology of glory takes the same experience in life but is fed by a hope that doesn't have to look away from death and suffering in order to proceed through it or to bear up in it. So in some sense, I suppose there's probably a willingness, but it's not a seeking of suffering.
I just think of not just black and white, like two different kinds of people I've met, but two different kinds of encounters I've had with people. One, I think of a certain person who a lot of bad things had happened, and he just responded to it almost by not admitting that they were bad, or somehow that made me very weary to be around him, really tired. And it was like, he wouldn't admit that he had failed or that there was not a problem, and it was just somehow it wasn't a genuineness. And he is not even a Christian, or not even, you know, it was not a religious thing at all. And then another person who had gone through an awful lot, and yet had somehow a sense of, I just guess faced it head on. But again, not a person who was religious necessarily. Mm-hmm.
May or may not be the case. Yeah.
And with that person, even though he had, you know, some of the same things had happened to him, and he was also pouring himself out to me, it wasn't a weary thing for me at all.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a burdening at all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the other one was not almost trying to tell me that there was nothing wrong, and that was I couldn't bear that hardly. The other person was, and the other person, his situation looked even worse. But it wasn't at all as to me heavy. I didn't feel heavy.
Yeah. Because person number two already displayed that there was hope for him.
Yeah, I think so. I think, and I got the definite sense that the other person had to come to that same point before he would be able to go anywhere.
Robert Gaiser from Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary lectured in Kashmir, and he was on Theology of the Cross for one of the lectures, and he said, take Simon Peter before he denied his Lord, and just read in the New Testament. He always had the right answer. He always spoke up. And after he denied his Lord, see how sensitive he was to other people, what have you, and just say, which one would you rather have as your pastor? Or, and he looked at all the women, which man would you rather be married to? Everybody knew exactly.
Yeah. That's good.
I work in pediatric nursing, and you see the doctor's parents, well, others too, just going to great, great lengths to avoid death.
Mm.
You know, sometimes it's unreal and you can hardly stand it.
Mm. Hall's critique doesn't really get into so much how individual persons handle it. One can draw some conclusions, I think, from it, or the psychology of it. His is more cultural and social in a very broad sense, but I think there's some transference there too. I think that a lot of things in our country show this, the experience of having been the world power at the end of World War II and had things going our way, moving now into a kind of multi polar world where we don't have everything going our way, but where we are almost desperate not to lose control, you know. And that's the same sort of not sort of facing up to change realities.
Can I take that off on a tangent?
I did.
I was wondering if there'd be any relation between that book and Enough is Enough. And I'm sure it's got to be kind of far off. But I was talking with one person this morning about wondering if we don't cause this polarization like you're talking about in our technological time by being not practicing moderation in knowledge and technology and mm-hmm. so forth. That we're just going off the charts, you know, with the information explosion and paper explosion and all that. And here I am, a librarian, complaining about too much knowledge. And that's kind of contradictory. But I see it on an individual basis, how it affects, you know, just who I live with, you know, in terms of if too much time is spent on soaking up all the knowledge and climbing into technology and, you know, just trying to get as deep into that and yet not experiencing life and relationship enough, you know, the imbalance that that can cause and the polarity it causes. And I sometimes feel really out of it as a layperson without seminary training in certain discussions and so forth. And yet I can intuitively make good contributions to discussion mm-hmm. without having gone through all that soaking up of words, you know, millions upon words that some people just seem to have a real drive for. And I wonder if that isn't a societal Western sort of thing that is separating us, just as clergy and laity become separated and...
They all get their own jargon and...
Yeah, yeah, oh.
I mean, it's just learning the words.
Yeah, it's sort of like they can't speak from themselves. They always mm-hmm. have to quote something. And, you know, I don't want to lay any guilt on people here. But, you know, I just think that getting too much into that, you're missing out on the experience of life. And I liked John's sharing the other night about being with older people and having good discussion with them and then saying, hey, you know, you paid some attention to us. And that maybe the people who lived through the Depression and so forth, from their experience, have a lot more to share than we're giving them a chance to mm-hmm. do, and how they could help shape us more. And if we use knowledge and accumulation of technology and so forth, more to shape what we personally are experiencing, you know, to give some sense to it rather than just seeking it for its own sake. Now here, you know, I'm as into it in one way as other people because I happen to be fascinated by computer science and I'm in the middle of learning a third language and applying it, you know, on my job as a librarian. And, you know, I'm getting swallowed up on it myself. But, you know, these ideas have been going in my head since Enough is Enough was discussed. And, you know, it's one thing to talk about it in a material sense, but I...
And yet some people who are just tremendous scholars can make it very simple and very mm-hmm. explain it very well to you, mm-hmm. much better than some of those that maybe are very wordy. Or
the last part of the book talks a bit about a theology of limits. And I don't think Hall would say, you know, let's draw the line someplace at the point of knowledge, the search for knowledge. But we don't have a very clear sense of our finitude and our own mm-hmm. limits and aren't very wise about the uses of the powers that we have. So part of his last part there is an effort to talk about an alternative guiding image of ourselves that would have a sense of limits and an acknowledgement of our finitude and our sinfulness that might make a difference. It's the present debate in genetics, for example, you know, is a kind of rerun, it looks like a kind of rerun of the early discussions about the uses of the atom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so important to have some sort of sense about one's powers there. I wouldn't see it in terms of, well, I suppose there you can ask the question, are there things that we ought not to know? I mean, Leonardo da Vinci had a notion of a submarine, had an idea about it, but he decided that people were not wise enough for that thing. So he didn't go through with it.
P.F. Schumacher was taken through some place with high technology, and they boasted and said, we can do everything. He said, can you? Yes, we can do everything. Can you stop?
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I think Hall is really correct in his analysis of the guiding image. Now, it's much more true for men than it is for women. But he is talking about the power and its play in Western society and North American society. This came home to me this last week and the last couple of weeks with a close friend, and a separation of two close friends, and having a long talk with the husband, where he said he had been very successful in real estate, but that was just one more success in his life. I mean, he was held state track records and was an Eagle Scout and all those good things. And now he had come to a situation that he could not control. His business had gone out from under him. It's far from bankrupt, but it was a situation which he couldn't control, having major loans to pay off and not the cash flow and sales to manage that. The marriage was in such a situation that he didn't feel in control there. And what was bothering him, above all, was that he found himself in a situation he couldn't turn around, that he couldn't control.
He did not have
the resources in that, and he knew it failed. That was so real to him that it was a matter of despair. So how does one who is accustomed to accomplishment and to having things go their way come up against failure and not be able to cope in the ways that they have to turn it around? And that was a real case of the experience of negation in Hall's terms, without the kind of hope that the theology of the cross provides, which is hope in the midst of failure, but is not a hope that is dependent upon conquering the situation, you know, having it in your hand. Yeah.
There is obviously a large line between, you were mentioning earlier that this is giving me the feeling of pacific, pacified surrender in a way, and obviously that's not what he's going for.
The book that is another one of those that is shaped Holden that's most helpful to me in saying what kind of ethic of the cross would one look for is John Howard Yoder's book, The Politics of Jesus. There you have the theology of the cross, that isn't Yoder's terms, although you'd be perfectly comfortable with it, spelled out as a way of life. And it's not just a positive way of life, but it's a way of engagement. It's not passivity. It's not quietism. Far from it. It's real engagement in the political realm and in all areas of life. And that to me is a kind of helpful complement to what Hall begins with at the end, especially since both Hall and Yoder see the community of the cross as the important locus there. It's not talking about individuals striving in the way of the cross, but it's a community under the cross. I have to, our time is about up. I must warn you that it's a tough book to get through. And if you want a more readable book on the theology of the cross, it's one by Gerhard Fürde, F-O-R-D-E, Where God Meets Man. And that's Luther's theology of the cross. It does not contain the critique of North American culture and religion that this one does, and that is a powerful part of this book. So Fürde's does not have the advantage that this one does in setting you where we are. But Fürde's is a nice laying out of the theology of the cross per se. John Hall has written a couple of other pieces that are much more readable, that get away from the jargon that you mentioned. This one has the jargon of the systematic theologian. Those other books are a collection of essays entitled Has the Church a Future? And a new one, which is an effort to deal with some new images for humanity, called The Biblical Steward. Is that the right title? Yeah, I think so. Biblical Steward.
And an older one, The Reality of the Gospel and the Unreality of the Churches. That was very, very, yeah, very readable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
And, I've been helping Miriam classify some of the books for the Koinonia Library and so forth. It seemed like there's a big section on that type of thing. And there's one on Peter Berger edited a bunch of readings that I think seemed to deal with it. Or going back to the Hartford, what was that thing? Affirmation? I can't remember, that goes back to the 60s, I guess, what the future of the church is in America and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You might deal with some of that critique of North America that you mentioned, that all the...
What's the name of Paul's book again?
Light in Our Darkness, Toward an Indigenous Theology of the Cross. Yeah. It's been, as I mentioned, a theme book here. It certainly influenced, I don't know if the Winter community has taken it on as such, have you?
Not as a book study like Politics of Jesus or Poverty of Spirit or some of the others, but it was the theme book 6 summers ago when Walt Bowman was program director. A lot of people read it in the winter, but I don't think we've ever had it.
Yeah.
Politics of Jesus sometimes is 16 sessions in 4 weeks.
Douglas Hall is working on a new volume now, and I don't know the exact character, but it no doubt will be a kind of follow-up. This book has got very wide reading, and I think he's working on a major work that follows up on it.
Will Hertzfeldt reminded us when we had that theme that it was a little racist, Light in Our Darkness.
I was curious because when Henry Nouwen spoke last year in New York as kind of a concluding part to the peace rally and everything, his was Light Out of Darkness. And, talk about prayer as the way out. And it was a way to peace and so forth. So it's interesting that it's a nice contrast, I guess, that people like to use when they're trying to lead us.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the connection between existence or a person's existence and what you're talking about. I mean, it may seem too obvious, but it seems to me that the personal experience of limits is the thing that makes you aware of the necessity of the theology of the cross.
Mm.
It's just the way I look at
it. I think that's exactly right. Hall would say that we've denied those limits oftentimes.
Mm-hmm. But this man you're talking about, he's experiencing it right now.
It's certainly not a male
experience only.
Oh yeah. Well, that's sure. Yeah, harder to handle is right. For some men.
How many times will people or we say that was the experience that really let me be fully alive, but you always add, but you would never ask for it, you would have never wanted to go through it. So it isn't seeking, isn't it later that you really kind of understand how really important it was for or your own being fully alive, but at the moment, someone who would tell you this will be really a good experience. You really should thank God. And when you get a lemon, make lemonade. Don't you want to just say, give you a bumper sticker and a plaque for your refrigerator door?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's the dinner hour. Thank you.
Thank you.